This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, the sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, alongside my usual entry mate here on HRRN. That's former top trainer Jude Feld, our producer Lee Delapina, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and want to extend a very special welcome to everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us over the course of the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, and streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net. Welcome back. Happy to have you with us for another edition of Trainer Talk, and a really fun show planned here tonight. It's always a lot of fun to visit with trainers and hear their stories. We do this each and every Wednesday evening. But trainer Rick Mattee and trainer Tim Gleishaw are going to be our special guests here tonight. And JT, a couple of people who have some very interesting stories. They've done an awful lot in this game already, and looking forward to hearing their backgrounds.
Yeah, one guy I know really well, Rick Mattee. The other guy I don't know at all.
Yeah.
So that's always fun to meet new people and to listen to their stories.
Well, Rick Mattee is up first, the first half of the show dedicated to talking with Rick, and then Tim Gleishaw in the second half of the program. Rick, a Maryland native, currently the private trainer for Barry Irwin and his team Valor International. Rick, thanks for taking the time and welcome to Trainer Talk.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, Rick, it's funny because every trainer that we tend to talk with over the past, well, several months here on the program, we've been doing this show now for over a year, has kind of a unique story about how they became hooked on racing. And is it true that you give all the credit to your grandmother?
Yeah, it was my mom's mom, and she was a $2 bettor, and it was really her that was the reason I really got exposed to racing. You know, I grew up in Baltimore County, in Lutherville, not far from Timonium, and just on the weekends, my grandmom lived in a row house down in Baltimore, and I used to go down with her on Saturdays, and it was just something we did every weekend while Pimlico was on Saturday. We would take the bus to Pimlico and go to the races. So I was probably, you're talking, you know, probably like 1967, 68. I was probably 9, 10 years old at the time. And that's really how I really got exposed to it. It's just going with her to the races in the springtime at Pimlico, which was a longer meet at the time. And so, you know, we'd go, you know, probably, it was just something we did together every Saturday, go down there, take the bus. And that's how I really got into it. That's how I got exposed to it. Although I wouldn't work around horses, and you know, probably for another 8 or 9 years till I was older. But I had followed it pretty regularly up to that time, and so I was familiar when I came onto the racetrack as a teenager. I was familiar with claiming races, allowance races, jockeys. You know what races? You know the difference. Nuances in the distance and the turf racing. I was at least somewhat familiar with that just as a fan, just as a $2 bettor.
What really attracted you to the game when you were a kid? You know, was it the sport, the pageantry, the horses, the handicapping? What was the thing that really made you say, wow, I love doing this with my grandmother?
You know, it's really interesting, Jude. I just thought it was the neatest thing in the world, going to the track and you know, just seeing the horses. And we'd always go down to the paddock and look at the horses. And at that time, Maryland racing was pretty good. At the time, the quality of racing and the jockeys and the horses, it was very good. Big fields, and there was a lot. I just thought there was action. It was just something that just captivated me, even though I knew nothing about horses. I just thought it was something really unique. Like, this is something I've never... You know, whoever would get exposed to something like this. And I just remember when the meet came out to Timonium, and I started to go a little bit more just watching the races. I was just always captivated by it because it was a sport literally within 15, 20 minutes of the house that I could in some certain way participate in. And even at the level I was, just with grandma making $2 bets for me, yeah, it was some way I could participate in a, what I considered a big sport at the time. Racing in Maryland was a big deal back then. And people don't realize it now, but it was really a big deal back then in the late 60s, early 70s. So just the whole thing, I just found just fascinating, the whole pageantry of everything. So what? I can't really quantify into anything specific, Jude, but it's, you know, I was immediately captivated by the sport itself.
What did your parents think of grandma taking you to the track every weekend?
They weren't crazy about it, to be honest with you. It was my mom's mom. They weren't too crazy about it, especially when I started working as a teenager at the track and was, you know, kicking around the idea of making a career out of it. And then they really weren't happy with her. But you know, as time went on, you know, I think they realized it was the right thing. It was the right thing for me anyway. And you know, so it wasn't that big a deal at the time. But I do remember. I don't think they were too crazy about it. I remember correctly.
Well, it's always, you know, fear that you're going to get hooked or that kind of thing. And I think, you know, most horse players and people in the business started going to the track when they were young. And it is a lifestyle and something that people enjoy. But I think most parents have that kind of apprehension the first time. I know I lost a couple girlfriends over it.
Talking with trainer Rick Mattea on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Rick, how old were you when you finally decided, I want to get involved with racing, I want to work with the sport, and this is what I want to do for a living?
Probably I was like a junior in high school, so I'd say I was like 17, and the races came out to Timonium in the county, Baltimore County, which was just a bike ride away from me. I could ride my bike 10 minutes up to the track, and I took a hot walking job there. And then I did the same thing after my senior year, and you know, when I graduated from high school, I didn't attend college or anything. So when Timonium ended, I was a hot walker for two summers, and when Timonium meet ended, it was a 42-day meet back then in the 1970s. I just went on with the circuit, and the circuit at that time in Maryland went on to Bowie in the fall, and then on to Laurel, and then back to Bowie, and then to Pimlico in the springtime, and then Delaware. That was sort of a circuit back then. So it wasn't until I was 17 and really 18 when I worked around horses full-time.
Graham Motion told us that he considered, when he didn't go to the university or go to college, he considered his training under Jonathan Shepherd going to the University of Jonathan Shepherd. Did you have a teacher like that, a mentor that you worked under that you could say, okay, I went to this university?
Yeah, when I was in Maryland, I worked for Bill Wolfendale, and I worked for a guy named Alan Dearston for a while, and then I ended up being a groom for Dickie Dutrow, you know, Rick and Tony's dad. Back then from probably like 78 to like 80, 81 in around that time. But it really wasn't until I moved to California, I'd say, when I was in my early 20s in 1981. And I worked for John Gosden because when I went to work for John, you know, I started out as a groom and then I became the foreman and then I became the assistant. So that's really who I got especially close with, you know, marking the charts and seeing how, you know, understanding the condition book and things like that. So I would have to say he would have been my mentor. I was obviously exposed to the other guys in Maryland, but there was a case where I could really work side by side with a really top trainer. And Jude will tell you, at the time we had a really good string of horses. John had horses for Judmont Farms and John Mabee and a lot of the European people. And, you know, it was quite a magical time to be in California. And so I would have to give most of the credit, really, in my later stages to John Gosden, because that's who really gave me the chance to be his right-hand man and assistant.
Yeah, I think, Rick, you and I were pretty lucky to – I was just starting out then, too, in the early 80s. I had my first winter in 1980, actually on this day, October 23rd, 1980. I saddled my first winter at Santa Anita. But I remember when John Gosden came, you know, had horses there, and he had those webbings that said JHMG on them, and everybody used to call him His Majesty. And I used to love to go sit in John's office, and you were working there at the time, and listen to him talk to clients. And how he handled his clients was outstanding. I mean, much better than any trainer I had ever come in contact with. And it used to just be, to me, that was like going to school for me, to listen to him talk about the horses with clients. And he just had a way of soothing people's fears and explaining things that American trainers didn't do at the time.
Yeah, you're right. It was really an education listening to him over the phone, because I didn't have anybody that could do it quite like John. He didn't say necessarily a lot of words. He would say just enough words to explain it without over elaborating anything. And he was really good at it. You know, John was an economics major from Cambridge, so he came from a little different background than most of us did at the racetrack. So you know, he looked at things under a completely different, much more of an analytical aspect of it. And he had a way of explaining things to people over clients over the phone. You're right. He could put anybody's fears at ease with a phone call. And in good news, bad news, it didn't seem to matter. John knew exactly what to say. You're right.
Yeah, I teased him one time. I'll never forget. He was talking to Mrs. Getty on the phone, and he said this horse was a bit slow coming to hand. And when he got off the phone, I said, "You should have just told her the horse was a bit slow." And he busted up laughing.
Yeah.
But those were some great days. Some great trainers at the track, and you know, racing was really popular then. 25,000 people at San Ynon on a Wednesday, and I mean, just it was a whole different time.
It really was. I could just remember how hard it was to get to the racetrack December 26th at San Diego. Those opening days, you know, coming down the up or down Baldwin, whatever direction you were going. You remember how it was, Jude. It was hard to get to the track those days in the afternoon with people at the mall next door. I mean, I don't know what those crowds were on December 26th, but they were enormous. And, you know, it was an exciting time in California. You had, you know, Wayne Lucas really getting into it at the time. You still had Laz Barrera going great guns. And, you know, your old guard California. You had obviously Charlie Whittingham and John Russell and Ron McAnally and guys like that. It was Neil Drysdale. It was truly, I remember reading an article Andrew Beyer wrote one time and saying that nobody would realize the 1980s were the golden age for California racing, but it really was. If you look at the quality, I thought the power sort of shifted from New York to California during that time in the 80s. You saw a lot more West Coast horses going back east and winning than ever before, and it was fun to be a part of that out there at the time.
Did John eventually encourage you to go out on your own, Rick?
Yeah, well, it was time. John ended up taking a private job, actually, for Sheikh Mohammed in 1989 into 1990. So it was kind of time. I had been with him for a while, and, you know, it was sort of time. I guess I'd say if John didn't leave, I probably would have stayed several more years. I was very happy there. And I was really, at first, a little bit taken aback and a little bit disappointed because I thought it was, you know, a pretty good deal. It was still a young guy, and being his assistant, living in Southern California, you know, life was pretty good. But everything happens for a reason. So it was the right time to start out on my own, and everything worked out well in the end. But he knew it was time for me to go. I mean, he offered me a chance to go back with him overseas, but he told me, he said he didn't think I would. He thought I would have a very hard time adjusting to the lifestyle at Newmarket, and he was probably right.
What do you remember about those first couple of years when you did make the decision to go out on your own? Was it tough sledding, kind of getting started, or was it something where things went pretty well right off the bat?
Right off the bat, things were actually pretty good, probably for the first couple of years, first two or three years. I wasn't good at getting clients like John was. I never could really build on what he left me there, and that was my fault for not the things that he was very good at. I wasn't very good at, you know, talking to people on the phone and communication, which he was so good at. I didn't excel in that regard. But the first couple of years were pretty good. You know, I thought it did all right with the clients that he still had. You know, it's when Herbert Allen was still in the game, and I still had a few horses for John maybe, and a few of the European people stayed with me. And so the first couple of years were actually pretty good. I really enjoyed myself. Then I got down on horses, and then it just became a matter of economics. That was really when the workers' comp really kind of got out of hand there in the late 90s, and then it was finally time just to try and do something else. So like anything else, it comes down to economics. And but those first couple of years were actually pretty good. I enjoyed being out on my own, and I had a good staff of people, and I really enjoyed it. Stayed at Hollywood Park most of the time and shipped over to Santa Anita, and things worked out pretty well for a couple of years.
When you decided to make a change and do something else, how did you what did you do? How did that come about?
Well, when I first got out of it, you know, I was assistant for a while for Patty Gallagher and then Mike Mikowski, and I realized when I was working for Mike, actually, you know, I did that for a couple of years between those two guys. It was about 3.5 years, I think, I was with those two, and then while I was working for Mike, I actually got it. And I enjoyed being assistant to those because it wasn't the same as being out on my own. But, you know, I got to work with you know, larger group of horses, and it was fun. It was fun being back in the game again and being involved in it. And then I'll never forget, I was just finishing up one morning with Mike. I was working for Mike for the short time, and I got a call from John Gosden, once again coming back into my life, telling me that Godolphin was going to be looking to set up a stable of horses between Dubai and New York and wanted to know if I was interested in it, something like that. And I said, sure, sign me up. You know, so once again, John came through for me, and that was in the winter of 2005. So, you know, I'd done the assistant trainer thing for a couple of years, so it was fun to, then I was basically Syed Bin Saror's right-hand man between with the American division in New York. And some winters we'd winter the horse in Dubai, and some of the winters we went to Florida. And, you know, I was there for 7 years doing that, and that was, needless to say, a completely different experience and really a lot of fun.
Was it a difficult transition, Rick, to go from being the boss to then going back to being an assistant? Was that tough?
Are you talking about the years with Patty and Mike?
Yeah.
Or back to it was a little bit tough to go back into doing something like that. But still, I was at the track at Santa Anita, and both those guys were good guys. You know, guys about my age who, you know, I think they kind of understood the position I was in and all. And but you know, so it was a little bit tough. I knew I probably wouldn't do it forever. You know, being an assistant. You know, the call from John about the Godolphin thing, it came at the right time after a couple of years of doing that. So, and then being, you know, Saeed's assistant was completely different because he was over in the UK with a couple of hundred horses and basically gave me a game plan, and it was my job to sort of you know, plan everything out and come up with a game plan for the horses, and that was just a marvelous time. It really was.
You know, I started the program and I mentioned that you are now the private trainer for Barry Irwin and Team Valor International, but this isn't the first time you've had a chance to work with Barry.
No, I actually had some horses for Team Valor probably when they went from Clover. I was actually with Clover, too. I worked for Barry at that time, too, Clover, and then when they went over to Team Valor. So I always had like three or four for them. I wasn't their major guy. Usually they had Neil and Julio out there, and then for a while I think Mark Hennig was their private trainer, but I always had a couple for Barry. And then of course he went with Mark as the private trainer, and actually Barry brought up the idea of coming back to Fair Hill to me it was sometime around like 95 or 96, and it just didn't appeal to me at the time. You know, I was still in my 30s and still doing fairly well out in California out on my own, and it just didn't. The idea of moving back to Maryland in a rural area, this Fair Hill facility wasn't here when I was here. I think it was built in about 83, something like that. So I had heard about it and read about it, but the idea of training off the track and shipping every time you ran, it just didn't appeal to me at the time. But to give Barry credit, he always kind of sees things before everybody else. And I think he realized the potential of the place even back then, training the horses off the track and the benefits to the horses. And, you know, I should have taken him up on it at the time. You know, it probably would have been been the right thing. But if I had done that, you know, I never would have done the Godolphin thing for 7 years. So everything has worked out. I, you know, ended up back here just, 17 years later than I could have.
It's amazing how life takes those little twists and turns, and you never know how it's going to work out. But I always believe that it's the way it's supposed to be. And you certainly had some fantastic adventures with Godolphin and all of that, and it brought you to a place where you are now and training for a, you know, internationally prominent stable. So I think everything worked just perfectly.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
Rick, what would you consider to be your career highlight? I'll put you on the spot a little bit here and pick one moment that you would say, okay, this is my career highlight so far.
I would probably say it was the last year at the old Nat Al Sheba track in Dubai, and on World Cup night, just the American division, we ran four horses that night from the U.S. division. And it was two-step Salsa and Gallego ran 1-2 in the Godolphin Mile. And then it was either a race or two later, and Regal Ransom and Desert Party ran 1-2 in the UAE Derby that year. So we ran 1-2 in two different races with horses just from the American string. I think we had about 16 horses at the time. And to run 1-2 in two races that night, and that was the last year they ran on the dirt at the old Nat Al Sheba track, and then they took it down and put Maidan up the next year. But I really liked that old Nat Al Sheba track. It was our U.S. horses ran good on that dirt track, and that was just a magnificent night for Saeed, myself, and then all the staff that had worked with the horses in the States before and all. It was really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
If I had to pick one thing out, that's what I would say.
That's 25% of your stable being right there in two of the biggest races in the world. That's a fantastic accomplishment.
Talking with trainer Rick Mattee on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Rick, when you were working with John Gosden, you had the chance to be around some incredible horses, Bates Motel, Royal Heroine. Is there an advantage when you go out on your own, having worked with horses of that caliber? Is that an advantage for you?
I think so. I mean, I guess, you know, you utilize anything that you're exposed to your advantage. And, you know, working around horses like that and really seeing how guys plan, because it's not just like one race at a time. You've got to be thinking what you're going to do three or four races down the line when you've got a Royal Heroine or a Bates Motel. And that's something, unless you really experience it, it's hard to do. It's not like claiming a horse is a whole different sort of craft, a whole different set of skills, really, to do it. Some people can do both. But I think it's a little bit of an advantage to have. I mean, obviously, you know, the good horses are obviously a lot easier to train because they're good horses. But it's a whole different set of pressures and skills that go along with kind of mapping out a campaign for horses like that. So, you know, it was a lot of fun, and, John was very good at it.
Rick, just a few minutes left before we have to wrap things up. Hard to believe that we've already been talking here for just about a half hour, but tell us something that listeners might not know about Rick Mattee. What do you like to do outside of racing? What other hobbies do you have?
I don't have a lot of hobbies. I'm like a coin collector, and I do vintage baseball cards and stuff like that, so I don't do like a lot of, I don't do like skiing or anything like that. So I'm pretty much a homebody, to be honest with you. And I would say other than like the coin collecting and vintage baseball cards, which I really don't have time to do that much anymore now that I'm back doing this full bore. But those are the kind of things I kind of like to do when I get some quiet time, just piddle around with coins and vintage, like 19th century American coins, like from the Civil War and areas like that. I really find that interesting. But they would be the only real hobbies I'd have. And other than that, I'm just basically a pretty boring guy that trains horses.
I would not find you boring, but Bobby Frankel was a big baseball card collector too. What's your pride and joy baseball card?
I would say I have everybody that collects likes that 1952 Mickey Mantle card. It's kind of a famous card. It's a card with a blue background, and it's kind of the holy grail of at least 1950s cards. You have the Honest Wagner tobacco card that's probably the most famous of all cards. But of the 1950s card, it's the Mickey Mantle's first Topps card from 1952. And anybody that collects wants to get that, even an off-grade, even with creases and what we call off condition. And so that's probably the pride and joy of my card collection, I'd say.
How about the coin collection?
Coin collection goes a lot of different ways. I have like a $10 gold piece from 1871. That's a very tough vintage from Philadelphia, and that's probably the pride and joy of my collection. It's what they call a $10 eagle. So that's kind of the pride and joy of my collection. And then when you get stuff like that, you got to keep it in safety deposit boxes, so you can only see them. Once or twice a year if you're lucky. So those are kind of what I like to do when I have some free time.
Trainer Rick Mattea, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Rick, can't thank you enough for taking the time. It's been great to hear your story, and want to wish you all the best moving forward with your partnership with Barry and on through the Breeders' Cup and beyond.
Thanks a lot, guys. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, Trainer Rick Mattea. Like all of our guests who appear on the show, going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strip, so we'll get that out to Rick. And fun stuff, JT.
Yeah, I know. Rick's he's an outstanding guy, just very mild-mannered, as you could tell, and loves the sport, and a real credit to being a horse trainer.
Looking forward to our next guest in the second half of the show. It is trainer Tim Gleishaw coming up next on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
November 4th. After the Breeders' Cup, the Thoroughbred World turns to Lexington and Phasic Tipton, and arguably the world's most significant mixed sale. In just one day, Phasic Tipton will present a star-studded catalog at the November sale. Proven Grade 1 and Group 1 winners and producers, top-graded stakes winners, and quality selected weanlings. The November sale at Phasic Tipton. One day in November. Where will you be?
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, makers of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, here in North America, horsemen are protecting their horses with Flair strips. Are the strips benefiting horses in other parts of the world?
Mike, horsemen around the world use the strips to protect lung health. For example, South African horse at the Euro Variety Club regularly races with a strip. In South Africa, many graded stakes, including Grade 1 stakes, have been won in 2013 by horses wearing the strips. In New Zealand, reigning horse at the Euro Mufasa races with a strip, as well as many thoroughbred and standardbred stakes winners in Singapore and Australasia this season.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
The 2013 Daily Racing Form National Handicapping Championship Tour is off and running with tournaments virtually every week. Last year's NHC and Tour had total prize money of nearly $1.8 million. Jim Bennis, a horse player from Chicago, Illinois, landed the grand prize of $750,000, an Eclipse Award, and the title Handicapper of the Year. Find out more by visiting nhctour.com and join the tour today to begin your quest for the NHC in January 2014 in Las Vegas.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full-card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast, every day.
The Breeders' Cup.
Breeders' Cup.
What a thriller in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Ford Runner, Dixie, Mucho Macho Man. It's nose and nose to the wire. Ford Runner has won it. And wise Dan strikes the front, sticks his neck out. He wanted to win today, and win it he will. Wise Dan, super impressive Breeders' Cup mile.
November 1st and 2nd, exclusively on HRRN. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information.
This is Bob Baffert, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pennett, Jude Feld in our Lexington, Kentucky studio. A great visit in the first half of the program with trainer Rick Mattee. Always interesting, Jude, to hear the different ways that people get hooked on this game. Rick Mattee getting hooked by going to the races with his grandmother every Saturday, taking the bus to Pimlico. That was the first time we've heard that scenario playing out.
Yeah, that's the first grandma sighting.
Yeah.
But that's cool. I mean, if somebody has to bring you the first time, usually. I mean, especially when you're a kid, you can't just walk in on your own. So it's always interesting to see how somebody arrived at the gates of the track.
Hall of Famer Nick Zito told us he was sneaking into the track as a kid because they wouldn't let him into the track at that point. He wasn't old enough, and being chased by the security guards. There's so many different stories involved with the way that trainers become trainers and the way they get hooked on the sport of horse racing. And Tim Gleishaw, the 44-year-old native of Evansville, Indiana, is with us now. He's trained 245 winners to date in a career that is only 10 years old. And Tim, welcome to the program. I'm sure you have an interesting story about getting hooked on the sport of horse racing.
Thank you. Mine's probably a little bit odder than all the rest. I did not grow up in this game. I graduated from Indiana University with an education degree and taught school for 3 years, and was home one summer and told my stepfather that I really wasn't happy with the way things were going and in that career choice. And he told me to sit down and make a list of 10 things I wanted to do, and, you know, said to leave off like NBA basketball player and then not attainable. Just happened, the true story, an advertisement came on about on ESPN about TaylorMade's internship program. Not an advertisement, I actually think they had a special on it about TaylorMade's internship program. And we contacted them, and I ended up going to TaylorMade and working for about a year in their internship program, and then contacted some friends at the HBPA here at the racetrack, and they set me up with Bob Holtis as a hot walker. And you know, I just moved up through the ranks pretty quick through him, hot walking for about 6 months. I groomed for about a year. The first horse I ever took care of won at Oaklawn and paid $136.80, and that was about it. I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And through working for Bob and a couple years for Cole Norman, you know, I got a good experience of both nice horses and a lot of claiming horses, and this is where we're at. So. Oh.
$136.80. I wish I knew you back then.
Yeah, well, and actually, Bob had talked me out of betting more on him because he told me the horse had no chance. So,
you anyway. Got cold watered by your boss?
Yep. So
it's always funny that trainers always remember the exact price if it was a good one and they cashed a ticket. You know, $136.80. I love that.
I think I wanted to bet like 100 on it. And this is back before that. This is at Oaklawn Park, obviously, and they had no superfectas or anything. I think I wanted to bet 100 on her to win and, like, you know, various trifectas and everything else. And I think I ended up betting 20 on her to win and scratching all the exotics. So I wasn't very happy with Bob for a couple days.
And being a native of Evansville, born and raised, I'm going to assume that you cut your teeth on racing at Ellis Park?
Correct. My father had taken me to the races and, you know, seemingly enjoyed it, but I, you know, I knew that wasn't what, you know, people from the suburbs in Evansville, Indiana do. I knew nothing about horses, and that's why I ended up, obviously at IU and got my degree in education. But obviously happy the way things worked out. I mean, now, I guess what I'm trying to say is back then I didn't know going and watching the horse races that I was going to end up involved in it. So
did it give you some kind of spark? I mean, when you saw that TaylorMade special, what attracted you about the horse business at that point?
Well, I mean, as much as you can without being around them, I've always loved horses. Another interesting tidbit, my grandfather was a Shriner, and every year they have the Shrine Circus come to Evansville, and he got to be friends with a lot of the acts. There was an act that had Lipizzan Stallions, some people named the Smahas that spend their, off time, whether they're not doing circuses, up in Wisconsin. And I had, for a couple summers gone up there to visit them for a week and taking care of the Lipizzan horses and things like that. And I really enjoyed being around them and liked horses. It was just obviously not in a racetrack sense. I didn't have any background in that, but I've always had a love for horses as much as you can without actually riding or doing anything like that. So
yeah, that's something that we hear, especially from city people. I was a city boy, and that was the only place you could see horses, and you hear a lot of New York trainers they liked horses when they were kids. They liked cowboy films and that kind of stuff, and the only place there were horses was at the racetrack. So
and I mean, a little bit back then also, I agree with that, and a little bit back then also, I think that I probably maybe had the misconception in my head that being so close to Kentucky and following racing a little bit, most of these people grew up doing it, and just thought that maybe when I was younger that was sort of unattainable until the advertisement about TaylorMade came on, to tell you the truth.
I remember years ago, Tom Durkin, of course, the announcer at Belmont Park in Saratoga and Naira, had been asked about his involvement with horses. And he had mentioned that he's not real good around horses, much like myself. And he said his admiration was from afar. And I kind of took that same approach as well, because I'm not a hands-on type of horse person. And it sounds like, Tim, you were kind of in the same boat when you got started. What was it like working with horses for the first time when you went to TaylorMade?
They probably didn't know this, but I was a little bit scared.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a little bit of a background from the Lipizzan horses. Obviously those horses are trained out the wazoo to do what you told them to do. And they didn't, they weren't frisky. They didn't do anything they weren't supposed to do, dealing with, at the time at TaylorMade, yearlings at the yearling complex, it was a little bit different, and a little bit scared at first, but the more I had been around them, the easier that got. But it was definitely a good experience, because we're talking that I knew nothing. I mean, I hadn't even picked a horse's feet before. I had brushed them off and that was it, I had to basically learn absolutely everything there. And then, when I did hook up with Bob, from day one, hot walking. Well, number one, they took bets on how long I would last, because I showed up in my polo shirt and my khaki pants and, drove my Dodge Stealth to the barn. So they all thought that, I think Bob gave me the longest in like 5 days. The rest of the people that were involved in the bet gave me longer than that, or shorter than that. So that's a little interesting story too. But I hooked up with a couple of the grooms right away, just so I could learn from them. And every day I'd stay after, it really helped me and worked out for the best. But going in, I knew absolutely nothing. So it was a little intimidating. Let's put it like that.
Did you have a moment or two where you just said, "What on earth was I thinking? Why did I ever leave teaching for this?"
Believe it or not, I can't remember that I did. I'm sure maybe I did, but, it was just, it was a very, very, very good experience there. Obviously they do a lot more with the breeding end, and that just wasn't my thing, going to the sale, and they'd have horses go sell for $3, $4, $5 million. And I'm like, I knew after going to some of the sales, that that's not where I wanted to be, because I wanted to be where the end result was, you know, how they run on the racetrack. You know, and I'd heard all the stories that it's going to take you 8-10 years to move up. And, you know, my parents, thankfully, supported me, because believe me, when I was hot walking, and I didn't stay on the backside at the racetrack. You know, I stayed at the extended stay and or apartment, all the places we went. And believe me, they had to pay for it, because the hot walker salary doesn't cover that. So, you know, it's all ended up well, though, so far.
That's great. That's a fantastic story, really.
What was the biggest thing or the most important thing that you learned when you were working with Bob Holtus, a guy who was in the game for 50 years and one of the true good guys in the sport? What did he teach you that you still incorporate today?
Oh, Lord. Countless things. Number one, I guess, and some jocks agents would argue with you about this, but just being patient with horses. You know, I've been told I run them too much. Keeps the racing secretary happy, but, you know, some of the agents, Jerry Hissom, Calvin Burrell's agent, tell me, you know, I probably run horses too often. But I think that I'm probably more patient than I would be if I wouldn't have worked for Bob. You know, he always took his time with horses. He was always very – I try to be like he was with owners and with the help. I mean, I heard him raise his voice maybe 3 times in the 7 years I worked for him. Now, mind you, they tell me that back before I worked for him, before he had his heart problems, he could be a little bit crazy as well. But that's not my experience with him. And I learned a lot of things. You know, I learned that, you know, we would be leading horses over at sometimes in races at Churchill and be 50 or 60 to 1 in maiden special weight races. And I'd ask him, Bob, you know, why are we doing this? And, you know, he'd explain to me, look, you know, this is one that didn't work out. You know, the owner spent $100,000 at the sale on it. And you can't just tell him, hey, we need to run this horse for maiden 30 right now. You know, you have to give them their opportunity. And, basically, you know, my experience with Bob, we did have mainly Cayman horses, but we also had a lot of nicer ones. Actually, I had Lawyer Ron for his first 7 starts because we had a lot of overflow, and I was on my own then and only had 2 horses, and the owner, Mr. Hines, didn't mind his 2-year-olds being with me, even though they were in Bob's name. So, you know, I got a great opportunity to work with horses that if I would have not been with a man like Mr. Holtus, that I wouldn't have got to work with other places, because nobody would have trusted somebody like me with horses like that. So I have nothing but good things to say about him, and, you know, sure miss him, because I would, you know, we're both at Churchill Downs, we were, obviously, until he died. And any questions I had, I'd still learn something from him every day. You know, anytime I needed something, I could go down to Bob's barn and he'd help me out. He was just a really great guy to be around.
Yeah, there's nothing like having your mentor right down the shed row and to help you out. When you said you run horses too much, I don't know if that's really possible. I mean, I like that style. I think a lot of horses get injured training. It seems like these days trainers want to just gallop them and work them and gallop them and work them, and they hardly ever run. How did you develop that philosophy of racing as opposed to training?
You know, a lot of that probably comes from my 2 years I spent with Cole. A Norman. We had mainly claiming horses. We had a couple nicer ones, Bowstown, you know, one of the Bing Crosby and Pie and Burger and a couple other ones. But mainly we're, I'd say, 95% claiming stable. And, you know, you and I both know economic-wise, when you have those kind of horses, they run more than once a month. You know, we have a nicer horse in here, Taptown. He runs once a month. That's just what we do with him. But, you know, we're not going to risk a horse, but the ones that run for the lower purses, just so it's economically feasible for the owner, you know, you have to run them more often. That's some other people's opinions back here. I don't necessarily think that we do. And the longer I've done this, the, you know, I used to sit down with the condition book and say, oh, look, here's a race for a horse. You know, it's 2 weeks back and another one 2 weeks back. And now sometimes with, especially with 2-year-olds and maybe, you know, in our barn, we have a couple 9- and 10-year-olds, believe it or not. Obviously now I skip that interim middle one, you know, and I do give them their month between races. But for our everyday horses, I don't think I've changed any. I think I run them, you know, when they're ready to run and run them in places that fit them as much as possible. So,
talking with trainer Tim Gleishaw here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tim, you mentioned having 9- and 10-year-olds, and I'm sure you have your fair share of younger horses that come into the barn now. What's more of a challenge, training a young horse that you just get for the first time or training those veteran horses?
I would say the young horses, just because you need to, it takes a few races sometimes. And part of why I say it's the young horses is come sometimes you have to convince the owner that, you know, sometimes it just takes a horse a few races for the light bulb to go off and it takes a few, you know, a few races for us to figure out what the horse wants. We just had a Birdstone maiden named Birds One that won up at Indiana on Derby Day in the last race. And I swore that he always wanted to be back behind horses, always wanted to be back behind horses and run at the end. And the way his first two races in his life set up, that just didn't work. That isn't the way things set up. And finally, he gets that opportunity in the last race on Derby Day up at Indiana and runs by everybody and ran a pretty big race. I think he got a pretty low number, but I sort of throw that out, you know. The older horses that we have in our barn, at least, are pretty much professionals, and they do everything, you know, all on their own and have for years. We have a horse named Unreachable Star, who is the highest money earner in Indiana history. He's made almost $800,000. He's very professional, goes out and does exactly what he's supposed to do. Grand Traverse, we have that's 9. We just retired last spring Reddy's Rocket, who is the modern day record holder and wins at Churchill Downs. Those horses pretty much trained themselves, you know. When there was a race coming up, they were ready. 2-year-olds, especially new 2-year-olds, it's a little bit more difficult. We have a couple promising ones in here, but who knows what they'll end up being.
And of course, this year you're going to be represented by your very first Breeders' Cup starter with Tap Town. That's got to be very special for you with everything that you've gone through and the way you've come up through the system.
It is. And, you know, it was very nice to find out this morning that he was selected to be in the race. It's still going to be an owner decision whether we go. They're still entertaining probably a race at Mountaineer or waiting for the mile on an eighth here at Churchill, but I'm pretty sure that we'll go. I mean, my personal opinion is, the whole time I was with Bob, we never had a Breeders' Cup horse. So that was 7 years. So he had obviously Pure Clan after I was on my own, but you don't know when these opportunities are going to come up again. So I think that, you know, at least my opinion is that we should probably go. The horse hasn't run a bad race. He tries every time. He has he's had the lead or been right there and just been passed at the end of races, probably 5 of those races that he was second in. He hasn't seemed to have bounced. I think part of that's because we've taken a month between races with him and found out that's what he likes. Obviously there's some things that I would have liked to have gone different in a couple of his races, but it definitely is. You take out the first 3 or 4 years of our career, or my career, I say our, cause I'm considering my wife in it too, but, when we had 5 or 6 horses and we're taking care of them ourselves, you know, basically we've only had what I would consider a decent size stable for like the last 6 years. So, you know, this is pretty quick to have that kind of horse. And, I think personally we have to take advantage of it and go and see what he can do, even though I will say this seems to be one of the tougher Breeders' Cup dirt mile races I've seen for a while.
Yeah, it's a pretty salty field, but, you know, you can't win if you don't enter. And, what the heck? I think he's a pretty nice horse. He's been running good for quite a long time. You mentioned your wife. What role does she play in the Tim Gleishaw operation?
She basically does everything. She's my unpaid assistant, which I get reminded of at least twice a week.
So she's the one responsible for all the success, is what you're trying to say.
I guess I should say that just in case somebody she knows is listening. No, she's a very big part, and she actually did grow up in all this. Her father is Ronald Ardoin, who rode down in Louisiana for years and years and years in the Southwest. I think he won 5,300 or 5,600 races. He's, I think still the all-time leading rider at the Fairgrounds and Louisiana Downs. So she grew up in this. There's a lot of stuff back here when it comes to riders that I get her insight on, sometime even her dad's insight on, you know, who would fit a horse best, those kind of things. Obviously, I think that I know, but nobody would know better than her and obviously her father, since, you know, that's what anybody that wins that many races obviously knows, you know, at least has a good opinion on who would fit a horse better. A lot of the older riders here, you know, Calvin, Robbie, they rode with Natalie's dad, so I think that helps some, because even if they're going through a slump, you know, maybe not riding well for other people, they still ride well for us just because of the family connection. But she plays definitely a big part. You know, she's taught me a lot of things that even I didn't learn at Bob's about the way things are back here, you know, because she's been around it forever.
Yeah, it's nice to have a partner that's familiar with the business and can help you out and understands why you can't be home on Saturdays to do things that normal people do.
Oh yeah, I think Christmas they got, you know, obviously Fairgrounds doesn't run on, no place runs on Christmas, but they were used to spending Thanksgiving Day, you know, they were from Shreveport and he was down in New Orleans riding. So I think every Thanksgiving from when she was, you know, school age on, they would be spend Thanksgiving Day at the Fairgrounds. So, yeah, that's definitely something I don't have to worry about is her not understanding being, you know, and I'm gone a lot. You know, I sort of, you know, we had an assistant up at Indiana Downs. We had a string up there, but I think I put 15,000 miles on my car driving up there because I think that I owe it to the owners that have horses in up there that I should still be up there, even though we have an assistant, if I can be there. I try to go with the ones that we've run at Mountaineer. Obviously, if Taptown goes to California, I'm going to go. But I just, you know, there's enough times that you can't be both places. You know, this winter will be a little bit more difficult. We're going to have a string both at Fairgrounds and at Oaklawn, and you know that's 7 hours between, so you know obviously that's going to be a lot less attainable, but I'm away from home a lot, and she understands that obviously from what her dad did as a profession for all those years.
Yeah, and speaking of jockeys, Tim, I don't know if you realize this, but you actually share the same birthday as jockey Brian Hernandez Jr., which is November 3rd, so maybe he's your guy for Taptown in the Breeders' Cup and you guys can get a nice present together.
Actually, he worked him this morning, and he is who's going to ride him if we're out there. And I did know that we're actually good friends with my wife, and his wife are good friends. So we did know that. So that nothing would be better than that. Nobody'd have to get us anything else, that's for sure.
You know, you really embraced social media. I see a lot of posts on Facebook, and you have a website which people can go to learn more about you with your horses and your bio, which is GlyshawRacingStables.com. Talk about that. Talk about embracing social media and using it to help your business, because I think being a younger trainer in the game, it's very, very important to really do those types of things.
Well, actually, my wife set up the website, another thing she does, unpaid again, of course. she said it would be very important for us to do that. And actually, when Facebook first came out, I used to make fun of my wife for getting on it. But then I saw a couple other stables, and I thought, you know, a lot of our owners were on Facebook. And I thought, you know, A, it's free advertising, right, number one. And B, you know, what a better way to, like, thank your owners and your help after you win a race. And that's basically what I do when I get on there. I try to stay out of everything else, even though I've gotten a time or two, said some things on there I shouldn't have, and, you know,
just like everybody else does, I'm sure. But mainly I just try to use it for our business and to congratulate the owners and the jockey and the horse after it's won a race. And, you know, seemingly every time we do that, we get 100 or so responses on their likes or whatever. So obviously somebody's watching it. Now, whether that's made any difference with anybody wanting us, you know, to train their horses, I'm not sure, but I know a lot of horse owners are on there. So my wife actually is in my name, but she does the Twitter deal when we have Tap Town Work Well or whatever. And, I just think that it's with the way the world is now, or our country is now, and everybody's on it, that you sort of have to, you know. I think that, the guys that are, you know, that are Mr. Holtis's age and that age group that don't do that are probably just, that's just another thing that would really help. But, you know, it's hard for those guys. You know, I'm not going to mention any names, but those guys that were in the Holtis age group, because, you know, those guys didn't even text, you know, when texting came out. They don't want to, it's hard to learn anything new like that. And I'm like middle age, so, you know, it was a little hard for me, but then after my wife convinced me on it, I think that it's probably a good thing. It definitely doesn't hurt, let's put it that way. Again, I don't know how many people it's picked up for us, but the website, you know, we can see how many hits it has, and people get on it all the time. Now, you know, that could be my mother and our owners to see when our races are. I don't know. But, you know, again, it for the little expense that it is, and especially since my wife set it up and we didn't have to pay anybody to design it, you know, I don't think that it definitely is just a plus. Any of the social media is a plus.
Yeah, there's quite a few people in horse racing that participate in social media, and it's a great way to find out about horses and about what's going on with people's barns, where they may enter, or if a horse is going to scratch. I mean, there's a lot of prominent trainers now, like Graham Motion, who's a big fan of Twitter, and even Christoph Clement's gotten into it a little bit, which is cool. So, you know, you're in good company, and you got to stay competitive. And I think that's one way that you can do it for not much money, and people really eat it up.
I definitely agree with that. And like I said, I don't think it's done anything but help us. In a worst case scenario, it makes some of our owners happy, makes some of our help that's on, you know, Facebook and Twitter happy, to see things posted about their horses up there. You know, obviously makes jockeys have, most every jockey that we use is on Facebook, so, you know, obviously they're tagged and all those things, and that definitely doesn't hurt either. So it's all positive, you know, as I can see.
Tim, only about a minute or so left, but we always like to end our interviews here on Trainer Talk by asking trainers what it is that they like to do outside of racing. Tell us something that people might not know about Tim Gleishaw.
Well, I would tell you that I love to play basketball, but being that I spend all my time doing this and am out of shape and could probably not make it up and down the court once, sports are still I love basketball. I love to watch pro football. Obviously, back when I was at IU, and, you know, Indiana was number one in the nation 3 years in a row, I used to live with Calvert Chaney, who played in the NBA for years. So basketball is definitely my passion. I would say second most, if you throw sports out, politics, even though I know not to discuss it with our owners. But, you know, I just like, in my free time, I like watching Fox News, MSNBC. I get everybody's opinion. You know, I just always been interested in it. Obviously, I hope I never have to do it, but have to run for office or anything. But I want to do this for the rest of my life. But it's just always interested me. But definitely basketball. I'm from Indiana, and, you know, if you don't name basketball as number one, they might kick me out of the state. So.
Tim, really enjoyed the visit here tonight. Can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us and telling your story. All the best along the road to the Breeders' Cup, and we'll look forward to seeing you at Santa Anita. All of our guests who appear on the show receive gifts courtesy of our friends at Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we'll send that out to you, and we'll look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, Tim Gleishaw. Rick Mattee, our first half guest. Fun show with those two guys.
Yeah, it's great. It's very interesting. Enjoyed it.
Don't forget, tomorrow we are back here 3 to 7 Eastern Time. This segment is going to be our BrisNet.com call-in show. Going to be a busy show, I'm sure, with the Breeders' Cup World Championships now just 9 days away. And don't forget, we kick off 20 hours of Breeders' Cup Week coverage next Tuesday morning, live from Santa Anita with our Breeders' Cup Countdown show. You want to make sure you visit our website, horseracingradio.net, and make us your home for the Breeders' Cup World Championships.
Yeah, going to be a big week. Very excited.
For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick Four, I'm Mike Pena. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton.
Good night, Barbados.